The National Broadcasting Company presents Clifton Utley with a commentary on the news. Here is Mr. Utley speaking from Chicago.
Good evening. 2 days ago, I received a letter from London from a very well-informed Englishman. In it, he wrote the following. "I hope you Americans realize," he said, "that the extent of your influence in Europe and the world runs exactly as far as the battle lines you could hold or enable European nations to hold 3 months after the beginning of a war. I hope you realize that your influence does not run one inch farther, and that it will not run one whit farther in the years immediately ahead. We Europeans hear talk seeping across from America to the effect that if war took place, the Russians might indeed occupy all of Europe, but that you would eventually fight your way back and liberate Europe, just as you liberated the Philippines. I hope you Americans realize that our Europe, that's been through 2 world wars this century, just isn't taking any liberation of that sort. Either America has to prove that enough help will be forthcoming so that military lines can be held somewhere in the face of Russian aggression, or else the majority of the peoples of Europe are just not going to resist Russian aggression if it comes. They're not interested in being fought over again, then undergoing several years of the night of occupation, and finally, maybe, being liberated by the Americans who would fight all over them once again. So remember, an alliance by which America promises to go to war if the Western European nation should be attacked isn't enough, and indeed isn't worth anything, unless Europeans can be strengthened sufficiently before a possible attack and be assured of sufficient military aid so that West Europe can be reasonably certain there is some line somewhere that can be held. If that line is at the French-German boundary, then the influence of America will prevail in France. If that line runs east of Belgium and the Netherlands, then American influence will be effective in Belgium and the Netherlands. But I repeat, it will not run one whit farther than the military line that can be held, or at least that European nations think can be held, 3 months after hostilities begin." Those are the words of an exceptionally well-informed Englishman, as set down in a personal letter received by this commentator the day before yesterday. Now, personally, I think the words of this Englishman are somewhat too extreme. It seems to me that our influence in Europe does extend, and will continue to extend, rather farther than the military line that could be held 3 months or any other number of months after the outbreak of war, in the event the Soviet Union aggressed against all or part of Western Europe. It seems to me that our influence does and will extend farther than this line, because the very probability of our being in such a war, and we obviously would be, automatically decreases the likelihood that the Soviet Union will undertake any such specific aggression. And anything that decreases the likelihood of Russia undertaking overt aggression does to some extent increase the feeling of security of the various nations of Western Europe. And to continue the chain of reasoning, anything that increases their feeling of security and confidence in the preservation of peace makes it more likely that they'll be receptive to our influence, that they will cooperate wholeheartedly in the European recovery program, and that that program will take hold and eventually remove the present power vacuum in Western Europe and parts of Central Europe. But if my British correspondent has thus somewhat overstated his case, it's important for us Americans to realize that he has only overstated it in degree. Basically, there is a kernel of very real truth in what my correspondent says. An out-and-out American alliance promising that we would go to war if Western Europe were attacked, and such an alliance is inevitably coming, such an alliance would mean something. But the enthusiasm with which the average European would receive such an alliance, and the degree to which his wholehearted confidence would be enlisted by it, would certainly be greatly influenced by the extent of tangible aid he saw forthcoming, or which he felt would be immediately forthcoming in time to keep all of Europe from being occupied by Russia should war break out. That fact, where we are concerned, means at least 2 very definite things. It means that since the Marshall Plan is a long-run recovery scheme, the recovery effects of which will not make themselves fully felt for a year or two, it will inevitably have to be paralleled by a military lend-lease program, which will enable European nations who fear Soviet aggression to get their hands on much-needed defense weapons more rapidly than they could get them out of their own production. To which you may say, but can't they use some of the Marshall Plan funds for such a purpose? The answer is no. because the Marshall Plan overall total was figured as the absolute rock-bottom amount of dollars that could bring recovery to Europe if all the funds are used for economically productive purposes. Stronger defense may be politically productive, in that by convincing a potential aggressor he'll be held if he attacks, it discourages the potential aggressor from attacking. But stronger defense is not in any direct sense economically productive. Thus it follows that Europe cannot recover economically if any Marshall Plan funds are used for the political purpose of directly and immediately strengthening Europe's defense capabilities by supplying military equipment through a new lend-lease. It follows that whatever is said by official spokesmen in this country now, a new military lend-lease, the sending of defense equipment to our allies in Europe, is a certainty in the months ahead. The second thing that follows from the argument just advanced is that the draft in this country becomes an urgent matter for this reason. We may promise an alliance to come to the aid of any European nation that's the victim of aggression, by which we'd mean, though we probably wouldn't say, Russian aggression. Even if we don't make such a promise, such an alliance virtually exists today, in fact, at the present time, for with the exception of Italy and possibly the Scandinavian nations, Russia could not aggress against Western Europe without first attacking our troops in Germany. And once she did that, the full-scale shooting war with us would be on. So regard the alliance as existing now in fact and as likely to exist later in form. Still, for the reasons that my British friend points out, European nations are not likely to be too completely impressed by the alliance unless they see us taking the steps that would enable us to back it up in fact and hold line somewhere in Europe if a showdown came. And in addition to the supplying of tangible military equipment on new lend-lease account, the other thing that would really impress Western Europe and also Russia with the fact that we would probably be able to hold somewhere would be a renewal of selective service. Intuitively, our Congress is aware of this, and that's why the draft is making such speedy progress in Congress. It will continue to progress, and when passed, it will do more than any one other thing to encourage Western Europe to have faith in its ability to hold some line if war should come. And once Europeans come to have confidence that some line can be held, their confidence that war will not take place will rise rapidly, and recovery will take hold all the faster. For one thing, most Europeans are convinced that Russia, whatever her aggressive intentions, does not want a full-scale shooting war at any time in the foreseeable future, though she might accept a secondary conflict if she thought she could overrun or cow into submission war-weary European nations and have everything over before we could come into the picture. Incidentally, since Italy is the nation most precariously perched on the fence tonight, it would obviously have a further beneficial effect on the Italian election outlook could Congress make further and rapid progress in speeding draft legislation during next week, thus before next Sunday's Italian elections. Admittedly, the Italian picture does seem somewhat more encouraging than it did a few weeks ago, but this is obviously no time for the West to relax its efforts to help the forces of Italian democracy and independence. And now, I want to turn to one aspect of our domestic political situation, which we in the Middle West have remarked, but which has not been sufficiently noted in the East or abroad. And this despite the fact that it indicates how completely isolationism is dead in those parts of America where it has traditionally been strongest. I refer, of course, to one aspect of last week's Republican primary in Wisconsin. In that primary, General MacArthur did not give any voice to his political views. Therefore, Wisconsin citizens had to make up their minds whether to vote for or against MacArthur on the basis of the expressions and records of those who were boosting the MacArthur candidacy. It's quite significant that back in the MacArthur campaign in Wisconsin, you had both isolationists of the left and isolationists of the right. You had the William Randolph Hearst Press and Colonel Robert McCormick Chicago Tribune, which circulates quite heavily in Wisconsin. Both of these journals have traditionally represented conservative isolation. In addition, you had many of the erstwhile America First Committee members known to be backing the MacArthur candidacy, and these too, in general, represented isolation of the right. But in addition, you had Phil La Follette, who definitely represents the Wisconsin left-wing tradition. You had Phil La Follette assuring his supporters and all others who would listen that MacArthur was a sterling liberal. In Wisconsin, the La Follette name has always represented isolationism of the very advanced left, though, and it's important to add this qualification, though always falling short of any connection with communism. Now then, you had in the MacArthur candidacy in Wisconsin, a traditionally isolationist state, you had a candidacy that had isolationist backing from both the left and the right, and which opposed Harold Stassen, who has been an unwavering internationalist from his first political pronouncement right down to this moment. Stassen won. I think this shows something pretty definite about the death of isolation in one of our strongest bastions of isolation in the country. Indeed, were it not for my own state of Illinois, from where I'm speaking, were it not for Illinois, I'd term Wisconsin traditionally the strongest bastion of isolation in the United States. But no more. And I believe one can say no more in Illinois either. These are developments that, perhaps thus far, have been insufficiently noted in the eastern parts of our country. And they certainly have not been sufficiently interpreted abroad. But the meaning will be progressively appreciated throughout Europe. And when it is, it too will increase the confidence and strength of the forces of freedom and resistance to totalitarian aggression. Now, just a brief postscript on the coal situation. John L. Lewis, by agreeing to completion of the membership of the Miners' Pension Fund trustees, has again proved that he's one of the greatest showmen since P.T. Barnum. He's showing it again tonight by allowing today's meeting of the fund trustees to adjourn without reaching any agreement, and by keeping us wondering overnight whether his miners will or will not go back to work tomorrow or Tuesday. But note this, whether they go back or not, and whatever the terms of the settlement that will be reached shortly to end the pension dispute, John L. Lewis, in the most important sense, has increased his bargaining power. By greatly drawing down the nation's coal reserves, by shutting down a part of the nation's steel industry, and by threatening the rest with shutdown, Lewis has made it a certainty that when the present Union coal contract runs out in July, his, that is Lewis's, bargaining power will be very strong. For there is not time to rebuild the coal reserve between now and July. Thus, if Lewis, who certainly will make further demands when the present contract runs out, if Lewis pulls a strike in July, he'll do so with the assurance that the nation cannot hold out long without coal production. And even if the Taft-Hartley law should operate to keep the miners at work for 80 days after July 1st, as it might, that would bring the strike around September 20th. Thus, the strike would come at the very beginning of fall, the very time the nation might find a coal strike the most embarrassing to its whole industrial and its international position. Now, one more word on the political aspects of the most recent coal developments. By being the person to engineer the agreement that restored the full membership of the Coal Pension Fund Trustees Board, by being that person, House Speaker Joe Martin has made himself a much more eligible dark horse contender for the GOP presidential nomination. All of which is certainly very agreeable to those Republican groups who have supported MacArthur or Taft, but who now regard MacArthur as out of the running since Wisconsin, and who expect Taft to be stymied by a convention deadlock. The improved position of Martin is, of course, less agreeable to those who opposed MacArthur, who expected Taft and Dewey to deadlock in convention, and who then planned, and still plan, to make a quick switch to a ticket of Vandenberg and Stassen. In a not too remote way, there are overtones of Joe Martin against Vandenberg in the event of the past few days, even though neither Martin nor Vandenberg are avowed candidates for the presidency. Good night.
You have been listening to Clifton Utley with a commentary on the news. Mr. Utley is heard each Sunday night at this time from the NBC newsroom in Chicago. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.